On this episode of Skeptico, Dr. Ginger Campbell discusses how lack of interest in science limits our ability to progress.
Before we're going to make progress on some of these more difficult issues, we're going to need to have more people know what we already know. I mean, science knowledge, and at least in the United States, is abysmal. When I'm deciding how I'm going to spend my time, my priority is I'm just trying to inform people about the basics of how science works.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and we're joined today by Dr. Ginger Campbell, physician turned podcaster and host of the very informative and accessible show, The Brain Science Podcast. Dr. Campbell, welcome to Skeptico.
Thanks, Alex. I appreciate you having me. You've had some really great guests on your show. I feel honored.
Well, that's nice of you to say. And actually, I've been looking forward to this conversation, as you know, from our email exchanges. One of the things I thought would be particularly interesting is you come from a skeptical position, but you're not really a skeptic. And I think you do a really good job on your podcast, the Brain Science Podcast, of representing some breaking science, news, information on brain science, but I think it has a decidedly slant towards the existing paradigm, which I suppose it should. It is the mainstream paradigm. But I thought it would be really interesting, since you are trained in this area, to kind of have a discussion about some of the areas that we've covered on Skeptico that explore some of the alternative views of what's going on in consciousness research. So I'm really excited about you joining us as well.
Thank you.
You know where I thought we might start, again, from the emails that we've traded back and forth? It sounds like you've had a very interesting journey, if you will, to your job right now as a physician, emergency room physician, as well as your passion of being a science podcaster. So I thought you might tell us a little bit about how you came to the position you're at right now.
I'd be happy to. First, I think that I should say that as a teenager, I was a Jehovah's Witness, so I have an appreciation, I think, for both sides of the fence, you might say. I left Jehovah's Witnesses when I was in my early 20s and decided to go into medicine. And when I started medical school in 1980, the knowledge was much less than what we now have now. I think at that point, one opiate receptor had been discovered in the brain, so the whole idea of neurotransmitters was really just beginning to hit the surface. And at that time, what really interested me was the new field of mind-body medicine. At that time, what that meant was researchers like Bernie Siegel and Joan Borisenko pointing out that people's emotions and what they thought really did affect their health and how they did. Back then, there were a lot of doctors who really didn't appreciate that your thoughts and emotions affected your health. Now, that seems mundane now, but that's how far we've come. And so that's where I started. And at about 5 years ago, I reached a point where I felt like I was kind of stuck, because I was studying all these ancient wisdoms, and I was involved with people who were very devoted to bringing ancient wisdom back into the modern world, which I thought was very valid, but there didn't seem to be any place in their worldview for adapting to new knowledge, and I became uncomfortable with this, especially because I spent 1 year, I left the emergency room for 1 year and spent a year in private practice in a practice that was attempting to combine mainstream medicine and some alternative methods. And that's one of the places where I ran into some of the conflicts with the importance of actually applying scientific methods. So anyway, I felt really stuck, and I'm a person who's always reading, and that's reflected on my podcast, and I happened to read a book that I will say sort of changed my course. It was the book Doubt by Jennifer Michael Hecht. And it actually got me interested in Western philosophy. I'd spent all these years studying, you know, the East and just about everything you could think of except for basic Western philosophy, which I had never looked at. So then I spent a couple of years really getting into the history of Western philosophy, where our thoughts on a lot of major things have come down to us from. And I discovered that consciousness was really the place where, at this point in history, philosophy and science are intersecting. And when I started looking at the question of consciousness, it really led me back to my interest in science. And that's when I started to become aware of how much had been discovered in neuroscience in the 20 years since I'd graduated from medical school, when I really wasn't, you know, keeping real close tabs on the literature. Around 2005, in the summer of 2005, most of you know that iTunes started having podcasts. And the first time I heard a podcast, I was like, I want to do that. And ironically, I think I might say, considering I'm on Skeptico, the first podcast I ever listened to, I think, was Skepticality, the other right. side of the argument. But anyway, I really wanted to do podcasting, but at that point, I really didn't know what I wanted to podcast. I knew I didn't want to do a medicine podcast because, I mean, I just have to tell you the truth. When you get away from the ER, that's the last thing you want to talk about. So in listening to various podcasts and other things, I became increasingly aware of the fact that there's really a need for good science information for people that aren't scientists that will give them an understanding of how science really works, because so much stuff in the mainstream media gets distorted in order to, you know, go for the headlines.
And I think you do a great job of that. I think it's great the way you do deconstruct these books and add a little bit of your own commentary to it, but pretty much report what the author has found. And it provides, it's a real quick study. I mean, it's a great way to kind of come up to speed on something where someone else, you, have done a lot of the work beforehand.
Yeah, and believe me, each one of those podcasts takes a lot of work, which is why I can only put out two a month.
Well, I can imagine. I have to admit, and I've told some of the folks that I've had on, you know, I have not had the opportunity to read your whole book, and that's, there's just a kind of time limitation if you're doing once a week or even once every 2 weeks in terms of how many you can really do. So what an interesting story. You know, a couple things I wanted to kind of pick up on, and I don't know if you meant it this way, but I think it's interesting that you said that you understand both sides of the fence when you talk about religion and then you talk about science. And boy, I just really don't see it as two sides of the fence. I mean, I see it as a continuum. And I don't think I'm sure there's some people, but certainly a lot of folks like myself who look at some of the research that's on the edge of consciousness research see it as an extension of what we've come to understand in consciousness studies, not going back to an area of mythology or an interest in mythology that is really kind of wound up in a lot of the religions, even no matter how well-intentioned those religions might be. And I really thought that might be a good jumping off point for some of the kind of controversial areas that it would be fun to talk with you about. And I want to pick up on something that has come up on your podcast, and I think you've done a very good job of explaining how brain science research is often dependent on one or two highly unusual cases. Someone has a severe form of epilepsy that leaves their brain unable to store long-term memories, but they're able to store short-term memories and therefore able to seemingly function on a one-on-one basis for a short period of time. And so these extreme cases provide an insight into what's going on in the brain and often become a kind of fundamental building block to new discoveries. And I know I gave you a heads up in our email. I want to explore some of those cases, one particular case, as it relates to near-death experience. Because I think, you know, one of the criticisms I'd have is it doesn't work the other way. So we come across an extreme case. So the case of Pam Reynolds. So very, very well-documented case. And if I can, I'm going to take a minute and explain to our listeners this case, and then we're going to talk about it a little bit. So in the case of Pam Reynolds, it's this woman who's living in Atlanta and unfortunately has a very severe, inoperable brain aneurysm that she just cannot get any relief for, and the prognosis is terrible. She goes to various doctors. All of them say there's no way to operate on it. She finally finds a group of physicians in Phoenix that have this really kind of extraordinary, somewhat unproven procedure where they're going to, and they agree to operate on it. So what they wind up doing, the procedure involves bringing her body temperature way down, her going into extreme anesthesia to the point where she is, for all intents and purposes, clinically dead. Her brain is registering no EEG. There's no measure on the sound test that they do to see if there's any activity in the brain stem. You might want to explain that. But for every way that we have of measuring this person's brain activity, there is none. And yet, as has been very carefully documented by the physician who actually performed the procedure that just found the whole thing unbelievably, somewhat of a life-changing experience for him, that Pam Reynolds, when she recovers from the procedure that was successful, the operation, she's able to recount vividly details about the procedure, about her resuscitation, about aspects of it that no one else would know. And again, this is a totally unique procedure. There's no way she could have seen this on ER or any other way. And she has, in addition to that, a very, very profound near-death experience. So that's basically the story, well documented by very, very trusted observers and recounted by the participant herself. So let's throw it out there. What's wrong with this case? Why can't we use this case as one of the building blocks to opening us up to all the other data that's out there that is also supportive of this case?
Okay, first, let's address how this case is really different from some of the other near-death experiences that people are aware of. In most instances of near-death experience, since the event is totally unpredicted, such instrumenting of the brain to confirm no brain activity would be impossible. And so I think one of the points you're trying to make here is that this is a situation where we really have evidence that there is no brain activity to explain what happened. Am I right?
Not really, Ginger, because, you know, if you look at all the contemporary near-death experience research that's done, the best experiments are done with cardiac arrest patients. And we know very predictably that within 11 seconds of a cardiac arrest, there's going to be a flat EEG. So whether that person is hooked up or not, we know that there's going to be no brain activity after 11 seconds. And all those cases are very, very carefully researched and provide very compelling evidence of the same phenomena. I think what really makes this case unique is the out-of-body experience, which is reported by many, and then the ability to very accurately report from that out-of-body experience things that were going on at the time. So there is this, if you want to call it a form of consciousness, there is this consciousness that is happening outside of what we understand as our kind of conventional materialistic brain functioning.
Okay, well, I have to admit that I haven't read anything about near-death experience probably at least 10 years. So, but I have, you know, just incidentally seen enough reports where people said, you know, were able to describe their CPR and that sort of thing. So I didn't really realize that that was a particularly unique thing about this case. Do you mind if I just say two things that relate to my own personal experience on this before we return to this case?
Sure, of course.
In my years as a physician, I have only talked to one patient who had a near-death experience, and the typical experience of a patient who has a cardiac arrest, assuming they recover, which you have to realize that most people who have cardiac arrests die, assuming they recover, the most common experience that I have, and I have interest in this, I usually ask the patient if I have an opportunity, they usually don't remember anything, okay? But, I mean, you did a good job in your last podcast covering the numbers on that, so I'm not arguing about that. But anyway, I did once talk to somebody who had actually had a near-death experience, and it was kind of ironic because this person told me that their experience was extremely negative. They had gone someplace horrible, and they said, "You don't want to go there," which I thought was very interesting because that's such a rare experience. I mean, it does happen, but it's rare. Years ago, when I was more interested in near-death experience than I admittedly am at the present time, I read several books, and one of the things that struck me was the fact that people's experiences seemed always to relate to their own particular life experience. And I'm not talking about the fact that they see their own relatives and not somebody else's relatives, but, you know, Christians see Christian things and so on. To me, that was always a clue that perhaps somehow something in the brain, in the memory systems, were somehow involved. Now, returning to the subject of this case, I don't have an answer. I'm not going to say I can explain it away. However, I would say two things that I do know about. One is that I think that there is some very preliminary evidence that there are brain activities at levels that are not measured by current methods. And I was going back, I know I heard this on the Nature podcast, and I was going back trying to find it in the transcripts for you, and I couldn't find it, so I'm going to have to keep researching that. But the other thing is that we know that when people recall events, or even when they describe their perceptions of things, that the timing is not always what you would think. I mean, it's been shown with perceptual experiments that people can perceive things in opposite orders from the way that they actually happen. So if I was going to be inclined, which I guess I probably am, inclined to think that somehow whatever happens in the near-death experience is something in the brain, my explanation would be that it's that these two factors would be at work. But to answer your question of why doesn't anybody, you know, leap on this and want to go into making more research on it, I think there's a couple of issues, and they don't necessarily relate to skepticism. They are more practical issues. From the standpoint of a physician, you know, what we're interested in is, you know, living, being alive, things that we can use to help our patients be alive. And most research money is directed, clinical research money is directed in that direction, and basic research money is directed at things that can be measured. So I think the problem is that at least at this point in history, these experiences are not easily accessible for measurement.
But Ginger, I mean, really, I mean, go back, and you've said you're recording this, so go back and listen to what you're saying. I mean, it just doesn't hold together. I mean, number one, if you're suggesting that one, there's somehow some kind of brain activity that is going on that we can't measure by our conventional means, well, gosh darn, we got a Nobel Prize right there. I mean, that would be a revolutionary finding, that there is some brain activity that isn't measured by an EEG, isn't measured by that sound test that's done at the stem of the brain. What is that called?
Evoked potentials.
Evoked potentials. That would be an astounding, astounding finding. And moreover, if there was brain activity, let's look also at the experience itself. And with our latest tools in brain imaging and brain science, we know that the kind of complex experience that happens in a near-death experience of this type would involve all the different parts of the brain acting in concert. It would be something that would light up any measure of brain activity. So to suggest that kind of experience is happening and is happening under the radar, if you will, of what we can measure would be groundbreaking, would be unbelievably exciting in an area of research. And the other point that you made about that somehow, which is the other thing that typically you'll hear people say when they want to kind of dismiss this stuff, is that well, maybe there was some kind of sequencing problem or the anomalous behavior. Well, there's this kind of anomalous psychological phenomena where people forget things or rearrange things. And hey, these things occur. I'm not suggesting that they don't, but I'm suggesting as a means for explaining detailed accounts, which are outlined in the book, of the procedure, of the resuscitation. These are not things that anyone would know unless they were there experiencing it. So I think the simplest and most clear explanation is that we don't like this research because it conflicts with the cherished and closely guarded beliefs about how the brain works. And I think, as you know, I have this debate with my lovely, wonderful wife, who is a psychologist and has all this training. And even though at times she's not skeptical, her skepticism in that medical training kind of crops up now and then. And I have to kind of come back and say, you know, the way we really look at science and the way that science advances is not by looking at the experience that majority of people have. If we did, then there wouldn't be the breakthroughs. What we really have to do is look at the extraordinary cases, and we have to make sure that the theories that we have really encompass all the data, because it's this outlying data that's really exciting, and it points to a different way that the brain works. And I think that the data... You know, I just had an interview last week with Drs. Ed and Emily Kelly from the University of Virginia, who've kind of compiled an enormous kind of breadth of research, all pointing in the same direction, that it is really inconceivable anymore to hold on to the idea that the brain is, or that the mind, I should say, is reducible just to brain functioning.
Okay, well, let's talk about that issue, okay? Because that's something that I feel I have more to offer. First of all, you know, there's a lot of debate about what is the definition of the mind and what is the definition of consciousness. I think especially when you start reading the philosophy papers, that those phrases get thrown around and used in a lot of different ways. I fully agree with you that the mind is not reducible to the brain. And I think that for two reasons. One is that it's very clear that the brain alone is not where the action is, that what's happening is an interaction between the brain, the rest of the body, and the world. I mean, most of our brain is devoted to the processing of incoming sensory information. So embodiment is very important. And just try, even people who, you know, are completely materialistic, who try to say the brain is the mind, I think are missing the boat. And I agree with you at that point. They're being too reductionist.
Well, but hold on, because that really kind of sidetracks the whole discussion. If we get into the whole mind-body and brain-body thing, which I agree, and you've pointed out on your podcast, is a revolutionary trend that we've taken in the study of the brain. But what we really have to, if we're really going to tackle this issue of consciousness, I think we have to really tackle the dualistic nature of it. And that's why I'm not a near-death experience researcher. And, you know, the topic doesn't really draw me in personally. I don't have any personal encounters with it and don't have any close friends or family that are drawn to it. But what I think it does is more than any other phenomena that you can look at, more than psi, more than medium research, more than anything else, in a scientific way, it really brings the issue to the head. So did Pam Reynolds have this experience? Yes, she did. Thousands of other people have had the experience. It's well documented. It's well recorded. Do we have a way of explaining it inside of the current worldview about how the brain and the consciousness works? No, we don't. And that's when I think we have to either kind of face up to, or we have to say, or you have to kind of tell me where I'm wrong, where I'm totally missing the boat.
Well, what I would say is that I don't feel the need to have a complete paradigm in the present moment. I mean, the whole point of science is that we're constantly changing our paradigm, learning new things. I mean, for example, neuroplasticity. 20 years ago, They thought that we couldn't make new neurons. Now we know that we can. That changes how we look at things in many significant ways. So I think you're right that this is a piece of information that can't be explained by our current understanding. I have no problem with that. But I will also say that from my standpoint of, you know, the more that I'm learning about the findings of the rest of neuroscience, I don't know what the answer is, but I'm not inclined to believe that it's some non-physical mind as the explanation. And the reason I say that is that so much has been discovered that in the past would have fallen in the same category. We would have said, well, there's no way the brain can do that. Therefore, the mind must be something outside the brain. And we keep discovering new things that the brain-body complex does do that are very surprising.
I don't know. I think, you know, I've heard you mention that history before. That to me is not compelling evidence, because really, if you look at the history, the fingers are pointing in a lot of different directions. You know, sometimes they'll point in one direction towards this, as you've kind of alluded to, where we're able to explain more and more phenomena that we previously weren't able to explain, and we're able to explain it inside of this reductionistic, materialistic kind of paradigm. But there's plenty of instances where, you know, that's not the case, or where we're led in a different direction. And, you know, I wanted to also bring up in a recent podcast, and you're going to have to help me remember the gentleman's name whose book you reviewed. I think it was Rose, the guy.
Stephen Rose,
right?
Yes.
And what was the title of his book?
I think it was The Future of the Brain.
Okay, right. So Stephen Rose, and the book was The Future of the Brain, and you did a great review on that, and I think it was particularly interesting because you weren't totally in agreement with everything he had to say, but I thought you did a nice job of kind of laying out kind of both sides of the case. But there's a point that he made in there that I thought was just a great point that needed to be brought out and discussed, because I think it relates to this. And that's that I think it's human nature for scientists to become enamored with tools. And those tools then become the ends rather than the means to their ends. And I wonder if that's what's happened a little bit with our brain imaging technology that's really kind of exploded in the last 10 years. And it leads us to be able to explore and explain things that we weren't able to before. But all the exploration is purely a function of the tool. And so if we take a step back and we look at a couple of folks I've had on and what they're kind of suggesting is the alternative paradigm that we need to look at for consciousness is that the brain is somehow a receiver, a TV tuner, a radio tuner, and that consciousness is more or less some kind of field. Now, that's a very general theory, and it doesn't provide all the details, but until we get outside of the existing paradigm that we're at, we're always going to find new tools, new little fun things that get us more excited and excited. But what if we're totally climbing up the wrong ladder, have completely the wrong paradigm, and we're thinking, hey, this is the whole machine over here, and what we're really looking at is the tuner, and there's this larger consciousness that we're not exploring. So that's why I guess I quibble with your point about we don't need to completely understand the paradigm. And I guess what I'd say is we do need to take a stand and say whether the paradigm is incorrect or not. And when we overthrow one paradigm, you know, it doesn't completely eliminate the last one. You know, I mean, Newtonian physics still work. You know, when you drop an apple, it still falls down and hits on the head. We just know now that there's a couple other layers that we don't explore and we don't explain with that soul paradigm.
And when it comes to the mind, we have another thing that goes on, which is that if you look at people over time and how they've looked at the mind, it's always a reflection of the machines of that particular time. For example,
right,
Freud
right.
had a hydraulic model of the mind, which, you know, has been completely, you know, disproven, yet, you know, some psychologists are still, you know, attached to some of his ideas. But, and I'm not saying unconscious, because I know there's unconscious. I'm talking about, you know, the idea that repressed memories need to be released. But anyway, we better not go off
that
tangent.
I have before, but in the show. He's a totally exposed.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And in recent times, the influence of the computer model has really, influenced neuroscience. And in some ways, I think, and this I think fits with what you just said, been an obstacle to moving forward because our brains are not computers. Right. And one of the themes that I try to cover on an ongoing basis on my podcast is why this is so. But in addition to the paradigm itself, there's the tendency to try to squeeze our paradigm of how the mind works into these images. But what I wanted to say was that I don't think that the reductionist model is the only paradigm being used. As I'm doing my reading, one of the things that I'm finding that seems to be having a big impact in the last 10, 20 years is the role of evolution, because so much is being discovered about how much our nervous systems have in common with even the very simplest life forms. For example, the fact that the biochemistry of memory is the same in even a simple organism. And the reason I bring this up is, to me, when you bring up the tuning model, I don't really, and this is just me, I don't see how the tuning model really fits in with the fact that that what our nervous systems are seems to be an accumulation of evolutionary history. It seems that most of the things that make us uniquely human, as far as our brain goes, is in the frontal and prefrontal lobes of the brain. But a lot of what's going on is happening in the parts of our brain that are evolutionarily very ancient. And I have a hard time, imagining that there's some kind of, universal mind tuning into, aplysia and fruit flies' brains.
Well, I'm not so sure. I think we can look at the variety of data that comes out there and kind of interpret it two ways. If you look into etymology, and a lot of the people who are studying ants and bugs and termites and the swarming effect, I mean, they're kind of coming to a similar conclusion that I am of this kind of group consciousness. I mean, they're...
Well, you're right. In fact, that's something I just recently been listening to about on the Talking Robots podcast, one I think that's really a great podcast out of Switzerland for anyone that's interested in this. I'm reading a book now that's really arguing that evolutionarily we should look at our neurons getting together as a brain as being very similar to what's happening in something like an ant colony. So if what you mean by tuning is the individual components talking to each other, I didn't think that was what you meant.
And it isn't what I meant. If you look at the example we were talking about with the ant colony, we don't have a way of explaining how communication happens in the ant colony. If you look at a swarm of fish, a school of fish in the ocean, and we do an analysis of the motion of the school of fish, there's no way that the communication from that fish in the front who decides to turn to the fish in the back is happening by normal means. So there's some kind of group consciousness, there's some kind of group communication that we don't understand, but would be easier to understand if we had a model that says maybe there is some collective field that they can tune into at a speed other than sending and receiving messages in the way that we think. But all that stuff is extremely preliminary, exploratory, and I'm not advocating any of those. What really kind of, I guess, riles me, and as you can tell from the podcast that I've done, is this denial that, and this dismissiveness that we need to take and re-examine and be open to and ask those other questions, which are not, I think, being asked. And if you look at the way that we started this discussion, it's too easy for folks to skip over the Pam Reynolds case. It's too easy for folks to kind of just stumble right past the near-death experience and say, well, I don't really need to explain that because it really doesn't fit into how I think the mind works or how I think the brain works. And that's just a frustrating point.
But I think that you would probably hear the same thing from anyone who is interested in an area that's not currently getting, you know, it's, you know, a lot of attention.
What, for example, what? Give me an example.
Well,
I can't think of any other examples that are so fundamental to the nature of who we are, where we've come from, than this, that are so ignored.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm trying to say, I guess you're right, it is different in the sense that this is an area that is in an area that has traditionally been considered outside science. And that goes, you know, way, way back in the history of things, when early scientists, in order to avoid persecution by the church, you know, were going to go off and study just certain stuff and leave certain stuff alone. And now we're starting to get into a place where consciousness is the perfect example. Until 10, 20 years ago, scientists thought consciousness was not studyable. So the fact that they are not ready to go way over onto the far edges of studying consciousness, I think is, what I'm saying is, I think it's understandable and doesn't need, you know, any, for most people, I don't think it requires an explanation of they're trying to avoid stuff. I mean, if you look at most scientists' research, it's usually in a very narrow area. They concentrate on stuff they can measure so that they can actually publish and make some progress.
You know, I think there's another force at play here that we have to acknowledge, and that's, again, something that came up in the very early parts of our conversation today, and that's the religious aspect of it. I think there's just a deep-seated fear on the part of most scientists that if we step into this area, someone's going to stick Jesus in the mix. Someone's going to stick Allah in the mix. Someone's going to stick their favorite religion, and we're going to take a huge step back, and we're going to reignite this battle that's going on with fundamental Christians and fundamentalists in general, and that they're going to grab the microphone again. And I think that's real unfortunate, because I think that holds us back from really taking a step forward and not a step back, which that would be a step back if science became intertwined with having to kind of explain and address our religious mythology. That would be a step back. But when we use that as an excuse to not examine these issues that would be a step forward, I think that's, again, unfortunate. And I'm going to get off the soapbox now, because I usually don't do this much soapboxing. But we did get me riled anyway.
Well, I hope that's is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't know. The listeners are going to have to decide, aren't they?
Well, you know, Let me just say, since I can't speak for anybody else, I can only speak for myself. You know, what I'm trying to accomplish with my podcast is to try to bring out more of what the things that have been discovered that most people don't know about yet. I mean, if we're going to make progress on some of these more difficult issues, we're going to need to have more people know what we already know. I mean, science knowledge, and at least in the United States, is abysmal. You know, so, you know, when I'm deciding how I'm going to spend my time, you know, my priority is I'm just trying to inform people about the basics of how science works. I mean, I realize that there's obstacles to doing science that's new. I always, as a physician, think of the example of the guy who first realized that germs were causing women to die in childbirth, and he figured out that if he made everybody wash their hands before they went in to see the women after they were in the surgery, that the infection rate went down. You know, that didn't catch on for a long time either until they actually found the germs. So, you know, it is entirely possible that someday we will find explanations in a way that things like near-death experience will come out of the fringes. But you know, right now it doesn't look like it. And I understand your point. Your point is that if people would look, maybe they would find something. At least,
no, they've already found it. They just don't want to look at it. I mean, there's plenty of published reports.
Yeah.
But I think your point is a very good one, too. And I think every once in a while, I'm kind of drawn back to the larger picture. And that is that One, as you explained, science education and our understanding of science among the general population is really low, and it's embarrassingly low on a global basis versus other industrialized countries. And the other point of that is that there's still a lot of kind of crazy beliefs out there, and that's why sometimes when I get a lot of flack from skeptics, and I always think, well, gee, I see a lot of my views being in line with the skeptical community. I mean, I think as long, anyone who wants to stand up and kind of tell creationists that they're kind of full of bunk and they need to go back to sixth grade science, that's totally right. So I think your point is well taken. And again, I will continue listening to the Brain Science Podcast for all the sorts of great information that you give on the new breakthroughs in brain science. And it as I've kind of intermixed in this show and commented on, there's a lot of information in there that you give that isn't necessarily completely in line with your beliefs. So you deserve a lot of credit for that as well.
Well, I think you're doing a difficult project, you know, trying to look at the scientific aspects of something that's, I guess, I know that you're somewhat of a fan of Michael Shermer's, although not completely. You know, he wrote a book once, I think it was called The Borderlands, and, you know, he talked about how there's an aspect of science, always going to be an aspect of science that's kind of on the edge where testing and whatever is difficult, you know, hasn't happened. And that you're kind of talking about things that are in that range, and that's a difficult area, because I still think that one of the problems is the level of testability that is generally considered in the realm of proof for science isn't possible yet in this. But you know, I feel the same way about string theory. I mean, I sort of have doubts that string theory is really a scientific theory since it's not testable. And I kind of hold to Karl Popper's view of science that a good scientific theory should not just be testable, but it ought to be able to be proven false. If there's no criteria by which you can prove it's false, you know.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I think that is one of the fundamental aspects of a theory, is whether it's falsifiable. But, you know, we could kind of get into that whole discussion. I think one of the interesting and exciting aspects of science is that in several areas, it's kind of bulging out into these areas that kind of test some of those ideas. And I don't think that's always bad. You know, evolutionary psychology is another area that's highly controversial and some people are completely against and think is outside the realm of science. And yet, I think it offers some very interesting insights and possibilities along the kind of philosophical lines, but they see it as much more scientific in terms of what's going on. So I don't think stretching the boundaries of how we can explore and investigate these things is necessarily a bad thing.
No, I don't either. I just think that we have to realize that at any point in time, most scientists are not going to be on the boundaries.
Right. Hey, Ginger, how about telling us a little bit about what's coming up in your future episodes of the Brain Science Podcast, and maybe mention, I know you're involved in several other podcasts as well as a couple of blogs.
Yeah, thanks. The next episode of the Brain Science Podcast is going to be an interview of Reed Montague from Baylor School of Medicine, talking about his book, which is really about the computational model of the mind, which sounds pretty intimidating. And but I was able to get a good interview with him that I think will hit the highlights of his book. And then I'm planning to go into some aspects about the frontal lobe and the role of evolution in the brain. Those are what I'm looking at in the next few months. My other podcast is called Books and Ideas, and I don't put it out as often because it turns out that putting out the Brain Science Podcast is a lot of work. But I mentioned the issue of string theory. I did an episode about Lee Smolin's book, The Problem with Physics, early on in the Brain Science Podcast. Early on in the Books and Ideas Podcast. So if anybody's interested in learning more about that, I think it's episode 2. My blogs that I have right now are really pretty much tied to my podcast. I hope eventually I have a website, brainsciencepodcast.com. I hope eventually to put more brain science information up on there in between podcasts, but I don't really have enough subscribers right now to justify that, so I'm really concentrating on the podcast.
Please keep it going. There's plenty of us out here who may not show up in the statistics that are very interested in what you're doing and use the information and kind of redo it and churn it out there. So it's really valuable information.
And I love to listen. I love to have feedback from people. So anyone that wants to can write to me at docartemis@gmail.com.
Great. And we'll be sure to put that link in the show notes as well as a link to your Brain Science Podcast.
I appreciate you having me, Alex.
Oh, it's been great. I really enjoyed it, and we'll check in with you occasionally and kind of see what's going on in your podcast and see if there's any more intersection with what we're doing over here on Skeptico.
Okay, great.
Okay, Ginger, thanks again.
Thanks.
Thanks again to Dr. Ginger Campbell from the Brain Science Podcast for joining me today. If you'd like more information on Dr. Campbell's podcast, please check out the Skeptico website and our show notes. That's skeptiko.com. You'll also find links to our previous shows. If you haven't listened to Dr. Raymond Moody from last week, it's a very interesting interview. We got a lot of very great positive feedback from y'all on that one. And we have some very exciting interviews coming up in the next few weeks. So continue thinking about us, writing about Skeptico. Tell all your friends to tune in and listen. Let's create a great, vibrant community that's not afraid to follow the data wherever it leads, regardless of who's kind of standing on the other side. So until next week, bye for now.